CIA and military involvement then. And then, and this is something that Daniel Garcia Peña is very clear about, in the 1990s, late 90s and early 80s, which he initiated in part of those last negotiations, the attempt was, when they were just about to negotiate and begin a process of peace back then, the response was Plan Colombia, militarization, strengthening the armed forces. And now people are, you know, historically looking at it and saying, well, the U.S., if it wasn't for the U.S. support, we wouldn't have gotten to this point. But if it, but the bottom line is 15 years have passed since those previous negotiations. Tens of thousands of people have been killed, millions displaced. And so we have to say, what has been the result of those last 15 years of war that might have been resolved had they looked at other options?
We're going to continue this conversation and post online at democracynow.org. Daniel Garcia Peña, thanks so much for being with us from Bogota, Colombia, Colombia's former High Commissioner for Peace. And as well, Mario Murillo, thanks so much for being with us. That does it for our broadcast. We have two job openings. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5 o'clock. The news is next.
Hey, fellow weirdo. This is Rich, host of Radio Lost and Found. Be sure to check out the show on its new time slot. That's every second and fourth Thursday from 10 to midnight. Radio Lost and Found is a two-hour media escape of found records, tapes, found sound, internet insanity, and more. That's Radio Lost and Found every second and fourth Thursday from 10 to midnight, right here on KBOO.
Hey, weirdo! Come out and play!
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 24th Annual Good in the Hood Multicultural Festival, a three-day event starting on Friday, June 24th, through Sunday, June 26th at Lillis Albina Park in Portland. This multicultural festival has been North Portland's number one leader in bringing together the community with food, arts, and live music. And on Saturday, KBOO will broadcast live from the festival from 2 to 10 p.m. Again, that's the 24th Annual Good in the Hood Multicultural Festival, Friday, June 24th through Sunday, June 26th at Lillis Albina Park. More information about Good in the Hood can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from The Art of Living, presenting Get Happy Portland, a two-day immersive experience of breathing techniques and meditation by global humanitarian Sri Sri Ravi Shankar. Get Happy Portland takes place July 5th and 6th at the Oregon Convention Center. Tickets and information are available at gethappyportland.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the U.S. Supreme Court upholds affirmative action but rejects Obama's immigrant rights plan.
A new report shows more teens have not started smoking cannabis in Colorado since legalization there.
And one of the largest grant-giving organizations in Oregon is in hot water for not giving money to programs serving people of color and LGBTIQ communities.
Good evening. This is KBOO Evening News for Thursday, June 23rd, 2016. I'm Natasha Delapine.
And I'm Sam Bowman. In a day of major decisions, the hobbled U.S. Supreme Court upheld the concept of affirmative action today. Justices voted 4-3 to reject the challenge to race-based admissions at the University of Texas at Austin, arguing that universities should have the right to define, quote, those intangible qualities which are incapable of objective measurement but which make for greatness. Observers say the decision was unexpected but stands as a landmark, defining the law for years to come. The case involved a white female student named Abigail Fisher, who sued the University of Texas in 2013, claiming that the university's consideration of the race of applicants was unconstitutional. Opponents of affirmative action vowed to continue to challenge the law at other schools.
The Supreme Court today split 4-4 in a case challenging President Barack Obama's immigration plan, leaving in place a lower court ruling that blocked immigration rights. The ruling was only 9 words long. It said, quote, the judgment is affirmed by an equally divided court. Observers say the ruling failed to establish a precedent, but stands as an historic disappointment at a time when millions hoped there would be at least a victory for undocumented workers. The tie ruling also killed Obama's hope for a presidential legacy, ensuring immigrant rights. An estimated 5 million undocumented immigrants would have been protected from deportation and allowed to legally work in the United States.
A preliminary report from a federal agency investigating the oil train derailment near Mosier, Oregon, has shed some light on the causes of the accident, placing the blame on Union Pacific. Despite this, the rail giant recently announced it would continue shipping crude through the gorge, prompting reactions from environmental groups and Oregon Governor Kate Brown. I filed this report earlier today. Today, the Federal Railroad Administration, or FRA, released a preliminary report from its investigation into a June 3rd oil train derailment and fire near Mosier, Oregon. The 96-car oil train operated by Union Pacific Railways was bound for a refinery in Tacoma, Washington, from Newtown, North Dakota. 16 cars derailed just after noon on June 3rd, and a fire began when a coupler punctured one of the derailed cars. The derailment has intensified calls by residents of the Columbia River Gorge, activists, environmental groups, and state agencies in Oregon and Washington to halt oil trains moving through the gorge. The FRA's preliminary report finds that the derailment was caused by a broken lag bolts, which are used to fasten the rails to the railroad ties.
What we call the gauge, or the distance between the two rails, was increased beyond what it was supposed to be, and a wheel of one of the cars, fell in between the rails, causing the derailment.
That was Justin Jacobs, Union Pacific's Western Region Media Director. Union Pacific also released a statement professing its faith in the safety record of its lag bolts and declaring that it will intensify walking inspections of railway curves in the Columbia Gorge. Today, Governor Kate Brown renewed her call for Union Pacific and other rail carriers to stop shipping crude oil through the gorge until safety issues are resolved, as the governor's press secretary, Brian Hockaday, told me today.
The governor called on rail operators to halt their operations. Unfortunately, the state is limited in its authority to compel operators to do so. Union Pacific voluntarily halted operations in the aftermath of Mosier, and unfortunately resumed their operations. And so the governor has called on them to implement increased safety measures to avoid any sort of future derailments until those measures are in place.
Now that we have met with the communities and done the transparency efforts that we have over the last couple of weeks, yes, we are going to continue normal operations through the gorge.
That was Union Pacific's Justin Jacobs again. Union Pacific's restarting of oil shipments has exasperated, if not surprised, Oregon's environmental groups. Dan Sears, conservation director with Columbia Riverkeeper, a group based in Hood River, was unimpressed with the FRA report itself, let alone Union Pacific's dismissal of it. He says the report's lack of insight into the root causes of the derailment and other events like it left the door open for Union Pacific to keep shipping crude through Oregon.
That leaves all of us, including our U.S. Senators, Senator Wyden and Senator Merkley, and our governor, Governor Brown, in the position of demanding from the Federal Railroad Administration an immediate stop to oil trains coming through the Columbia River Gorge. FRA has not committed to that. They haven't really offered much in the way of concrete ways to avoid these types of disasters. They suggested that enhanced braking systems could reduce the severity of derailments, but it was very telling in their report that quote, the tank cars involved in the derailment performed as expected, end quote, meaning when these oil trains move, when they derail, they will puncture, they will catch fire. And so what Union Pacific is proposing to do, despite the FRA's report, is to continue gambling with the lives of people along the Columbia River and with the health of the Columbia River itself.
Union Pacific has stated that its hands are tied by its status as a common carrier, meaning it has a legal mandate to ship federally regulated products. This explanation does not impress those calling for a moratorium on oil trains, as Dan Sears explains.
Union Pacific's claims are laughable. First of all, if Union Pacific were to acknowledge that oil trains can't be moved safely on its tracks, the federal agencies would not compel them to move dangerous cargo on tracks that are demonstrably unsafe. The Federal Railroad Administration has found that Union Pacific isn't maintaining its tracks properly, and so they've concluded that Union Pacific is at fault in this case. Now, Union Pacific is actively out courting additional unit train traffic. They make a lot of money. They make millions and millions of dollars, billions, from shipping crude oil and other products all over the United States. And so, you know, we would welcome a call from the Union Pacific Railroad to stand up and say that they want a moratorium, they want a ban on oil trains. But far from that, Union Pacific is putting profits ahead of safety, and they are more than willing, apparently, to gamble with the lives of everyone along the Columbia River. Their claim of being beholden to this common carrier status is really disingenuous when you consider the long track record Union Pacific has of pushing for increased oil by rail.
The Federal Railroad Administration's preliminary report contains no action against Union Pacific over the derailment, but does indicate that the agency is considering unspecified penalties against the company, which is the largest railroad network in the United States. For Cable Evening News, I'm Sam Bowman.
On Monday, the Immigration and Environmental Issues Committee of the Presbyterian Church, USA, voted to recommend that the church divest its investments in fossil fuel industries. It still must be voted on by the full Presbyterian Assembly over the next few days. In addition to developing a fossil fuel-free investing plan, it also asks that the church develop recommendations on how Presbyterians can take action against climate change. Throughout the past week, members from all over the country have been meeting in Portland at the church's 222nd General Assembly. The divestiture proposal, along with many others that will be decided on during the General Assembly, will be crucial in determining how the church will move forward.
The National Committee for Responsive Philanthropy has released a report on the Oregon Community Foundation, the state's largest charitable foundation. While the report praised its rural approach, it was critical of the foundation's outreach to Oregon's marginalized communities. For more, we go to KABU reporter Abby Sloan in collaboration with the Oregon News Service.
Oregon's largest source of funding for nonprofit groups has built a strong network statewide, according to a new report. The Oregon Community Foundation, the eighth largest of its kind in the country, distributed $103 million in 2015 to fund charitable causes and scholarships. Lisa Rangeli, co-author of the National Committee for Responsive Philanthropy's report, says the OCF's regional approach has served rural communities well.
Oregon's geography is diverse. There's a lot of rural parts of the state as well as more urban parts, and there's diversity within those different regions. So we were impressed with the ways that the foundation has tried to respond.
However, Rangeli says the foundation needs to work harder to serve racial, ethnic, and LGBTQ communities. According to the report, leaders in these communities said they felt that accessing funds was still difficult, despite recent efforts by the foundation to focus on equity, diversity, and inclusion. Stakeholders in the foundation said they could see OCF's good intentions, Rangeli says, but often compared it to a slow-moving ship.
There's kind of this echo chamber of voices saying they're a big institution and we see that they're trying to change course, but they haven't quite gotten all the way in that direction yet.
The foundation has responded within its own organization. A decade ago, the OCF established the Latino Engagement Initiative to serve Oregon's growing Latino population. Joan Viejo with the OCF says it's important to keep the complexities of funding in mind for this type of organization, where donors come from a variety of backgrounds and have different missions. She says the whole foundation has made an emphasis on underserved communities in recent years.
We really have, in the last couple of years, changed our grant-making application process and our priorities to ensure that underserved communities and communities of color have access to our grant-making in the same way that everyone else has.
While the OCF has made strides toward equity and inclusion, the NCRP report recommends the foundation make a better effort to communicate these goals and its progress to the communities it wishes to serve. For KABU News, this is Abigail Sloan.
The state police trooper nominated by Governor Kate Brown to be the next state police superintendent was put on paid leave 3 years ago after the fatal shooting of a white supremacist. Major Travis Hampton of the Oregon State Police had pulled over William Hall near the town of Sisters for driving erratically. A dashboard camera in the trooper's car captured the scene. After Hall passed several sobriety tests, Hampton and a fellow officer decided that he nevertheless seemed, quote, under the influence of a stimulant. They noted that Hall was covered with what they described as white supremacist tattoos. As the officers decided what to do, Hall returned to his car and got in. An officer who approached the vehicle was seen to have jumped back, then Hall's car sped away. Hall was eventually stopped by spike strips set in the road. Once officers caught up with him, Hampton and another officer shot into the car, but medical investigation showed Hall died from a self-inflicted gunshot wound to the head. Hampton was put on leave while the case was investigated, then reinstated. His appointment still must be approved by the Oregon State Senate.
The Fourth Dimension Recovery Center is holding an upcoming event called Straight Outta Recovery, Addicts with Attitude. Here to talk about that is 4D Recovery Director, 4D Recovery's Director of Peer Mentorship, Tony Vazna. Thanks for coming in, Tony.
Hey, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. And so first off, can you give us your sense of how common addiction is in our communities right now?
Yeah, well, for me, I work in addictions treatment, so it's very common. And also my experience as a person in recovery, I've seen a lot of people who use illicit drugs and marijuana. But, you know, according to the WhiteHouse.gov and the Oregon Drug Control Update in 2009, Oregon was one of the top 10 states for rates of drug use in several categories, including past month illicit drug use among persons 12 or older, past month illicit drug use among adults ages 18 to 25, and past month marijuana use among persons 12 or older. Also, approximately about 13% of Oregon residents reported past month use of illicit drugs, which is above the national average, which is 8%, 9%.
All right. And is there a particular philosophy behind your work at 4D Recovery?
Yeah, there is. Our philosophy is really derived from like Alcoholics Anonymous philosophy, one person who has that lived experience helping another person. And so what we did is we created a community center for young people to come hang out. You know, there's not a lot of places for people to go who are young and they want to party and have fun and socialize and do what young people do that doesn't have drugs and alcohol there. So we provide an opportunity for people to escape that, to socialize, that fun. And in addition to just having a community space for people to come to, we also have the peer mentoring, and we contract with Multnomah County and also some federal funding.
And maybe you just touched on a little bit, but what is it that 4D Recovery does differently than other treatment programs in the state?
Yeah, well, traditionally, you know, what you see is like residential treatment. People come into treatment and they live there for a period of time. You know, a lot of times it's like a 30-day wash. And I would kind of describe that as like an acute treatment model. People try to like, okay, we'll come in, we'll teach them how to be moral, and we'll let them back out in society and they'll be right. But what they found is that people need extended, you know, care. They need a place that they can go. What's different about 4D is that it's an open community center. People aren't mandated. They come voluntarily. Everyone on the board of directors is a young person who's in recovery. Everybody who works there is young people in recovery. And so it's really that lived experience and that ability to be voluntary that I think makes us a lot different than other places.
Well, and can you talk a little about what kind of activities you have there? Apparently, I've heard you have an open mic night.
Yeah, so, you know, in addition to being an open community center, one thing that we really try to do is we encourage the recovery community to come in and to use our program or our building as an event space. So the Sunday night poetry night is a perfect example of that. People come and they read poetry. People in recovery read poetry. They rent the space from us. We help promote it. And it's just one example. We have like blazer games, football games, every kind of, you know, social event that you could have. We have the same thing. It's just oriented towards young people in recovery.
All right. And what would you say are the biggest obstacles to the work that you do there?
Well, I mean, for us as an organization, what's difficult is anchoring funding. We're a nonprofit. Anyone who works in nonprofits knows how difficult it can be to get grants, and then you have success measurements and outcomes, which are really hard to get. In some ways can be oppressive and discriminatory, in my opinion. So there's that. And then on the other side, like people who are trying to get clean can have a myriad of problems that they're facing. And so we just try to help them navigate and getting their kids back. A lot of them are on probation and parole, which has like a ton of other requirements in addition to trying to get a job when you're discriminated against. And then if you're like a person of color, you know, your struggles can be exacerbated from that. So we really just try to be there, help support people, take them to meetings, take them to appointments, advocate for them.
And I'm glad you touched on that. I feel like a lot of people are very, they don't really know what it is that addicts go through when they're going through recovery. And just generally, what is it that people deal with when they go through recovery?
Well, a lot of people deal with a lot of different things. I can talk about my own experience. You know, for me, when I got clean, I was in jail, and I transitioned to a residential treatment center, Volunteers of America, right down the street. And I mean, I had like kind of burnt my family bridges. I'd come from poverty. You know, my dad was in prison. My mom was dead. I really only had myself, and I'd beat myself down pretty hard. And then I had all this stuff. I had to fix my credit. I had to go to PO appointments. I had to get off probation. I had to pay fines. And I had to really kind of learn how to live in life again. And so that was my struggle, is doing that, rebuilding my self-confidence, and kind of changing my perception on the world.
All right. And do you feel that there are any major prevalent myths about addiction in the United States?
Yeah. I mean, I think that people look at addicts or alcoholics as being immoral individuals. I think that is exemplified through the mass incarceration that we see around drug charges. And I think what people forget to see is that there's a lot of ways that, you know, we self-medicate as individuals, whether it be food or sugar, you know, pornography. There's a lot of different things. And drug addiction is just a disease where someone can be treated.
All right. And so when is this Straight Outta Recovery event? And let me just tell our listeners, that's STR numeral 8 Outta Recovery. When is that happening?
So that's this Saturday night. It was organized by a group of people younger than me. I'm 31. I'm not super young anymore. But and my friend couldn't make it tonight. She got lost. But it's this Saturday night. Starts at 9:00. It's for people in recovery. We're going to have a DJ. We're going to have a local hip hop artist who's in recovery. We're going to have young people who are going to be speaking. We're going to do a raffle, and we're going to give away some free Red Bulls and stuff like that. It should be fun.
Right. And where is that being held?
Our location's 3807 Northeast Martin Luther King Jr., right adjacent to Planned Parenthood.
Okay. And if anyone, any of our listeners were interested in helping out your organization, how would they go about doing that?
Well, if you're like a social service provider, you could direct people to come there if they had a problem with addiction. They were younger, between the ages of 13 and 35 is who we normally work with. Or you could look on our website, www.4drecovery.org, and you could donate. We always need donations financially.
All right. Tony Vazna, thank you so much for coming in and talking with us today.
Hey, thank you guys.
Yeah, and thanks. That was Tony Vazna of Fourth Dimension Recovery Center. You can find their schedule of activities at www.4drecovery.org. That's the number 4drecovery.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Rose City Native Radio at 6 p.m., followed by Hard Rock Radio at 7. And guess who's coming to radio at 8 with Jamila Bourdon. Tomorrow's weather is rainy with highs near 67 degrees. Today in history, on June 23, 1972, President Richard Nixon and the White House Chief of Staff, H.R. Heidelman, discussed a plan to use the CIA to obstruct the FBI's Watergate investigation. The quote of the day is from Richard M. Nixon, who said, "You must pursue this investigation of Watergate even if it leads to the president. I'm innocent. You've got to believe I'm innocent. If you don't, take my job."
It's 5:23 and 47 seconds. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
If bigger is better, as the old saw claims, does that mean that biggest is best? Not in corporate world. Chanting the bigger is better mantra, corporations have constantly been merging to become global Goliaths. As we consumers have learned from banks, airlines, etc., far from getting better, the giants just become bullies. So let's pay attention to another creature wanting us to swallow an extra sour serving of conglomeration is good for you hokum. You used to know what you were getting when you said to the bartender, "Make mine a Bud." But Budweiser has mutated into a multinational corporate concoction that's headquartered in Belgium, largely owned by South Americans, and now renamed Anheuser-Busch InBev, Inc. It's already the world's largest brewer, but InBev is presently demanding that our government officials ignore their duty to the public and let it take over SAB Miller, the world's second largest brewer. Beer quaffers of the world, unite! If approved, this bitter deal would confront you with a monopolistic monster of a cartel with dozens of beer brands, including top sellers like Bud, Michelob, Corona, Stella Artois, Modelo, Miller Lite, Blue Moon, Foster's, and Mickey's. The InBev combine would control some two-thirds of all U.S. beer sales, as well as nearly a third of the entire global beer market. Pulling in an estimated $64 billion in revenues each year, this behemoth of brews would be able to crush all other competitors with predatory pricing schemes or simply buy them out. This is Jim Hightower saying we beer aficionados would be left with a choice between corporate beer and corporate beer, with InBev setting the price and quality. This is a Teddy Roosevelt trust-busting moment. To support consumer choice and the thousands of independent craft brewers that InBev intends to kill off, go to brewersassociation.org.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
A week before Vermont's labeling laws take effect on July 1st, U.S. Senate lawmakers reached a deal today to label foods containing GMOs, genetically modified ingredients. The first such law to take effect in the nation, Vermont's law, requires the food industry to reveal contents of its products containing controversial ingredients, which are found in up to 80% of packaged food and sold in the United States. The federal legislation, if passed by both houses and signed by the president, will establish a single mandatory label for food products that contain genetically modified ingredients. It would nullify any state laws from labeling GMOs. Many opponents see the bill as weaker than Vermont's law, which requires packaged labels to say produced with or partially produced with genetically engineered ingredients. Such state laws would set up as many as 50 different labeling requirements, say the food industry, resulting in higher prices to consumers.
The consumption of marijuana by teens in Colorado has not increased due to the sale of recreational cannabis, according to a new study. The Healthy Kids of Colorado survey found that the percentage of high school students in Colorado reporting using marijuana remained at 21.2%. The survey takes place every 2 years. Recreational cannabis became available in 2014, and the percentage of teens using cannabis has not increased beyond its margin of error from 2013. The 2015 rate of teen pot smoking remained lower than surveys in previous years. Officials say the study results might help ease concern over the opening of new marijuana establishments in Colorado.
Documentary producer Bill Curtis is visiting Portland. He sat down this afternoon with S.W. Cosner to talk about the state of investigative journalism today. The full interview airs next week on the KBOO Radio Zine on Wednesday, June 29th at 11 a.m.
In the 1980s, you went on to produce a four-part series about the history of American spy agencies, from the birth of the FBI in the 1920s through the CIA's role in Iran-Contra.
Yeah, we went down to Bay of Pigs and spent some time in Cuba and followed primarily the CIA and the development. Golden Age, I refer to sort of the 90s and cable as the golden age of documentaries because You know, they were calling cable units like A&E the Hitler Channel because they were running so many World War II documentaries and newsreels. And then they discovered, more than discovered, they surmised that, look, if we produce our own documentaries, it will be a great identity for the brand, and it will be cheaper than running all these reruns. Indeed it was. It proved true. So I entered into the next 20, 25 years.
Well, you must have some opinions on the new sort of almost democratization of journalism nowadays and the new whistleblowing that's happening with outfits like WikiLeaks and Glenn Greenwald and Edward Snowden, who became a whistleblower from one of the NSA contractors.
Well, they are the perfect sources because they have primary evidence. They have taken this material and said, how do I get it out? So they go to Greenwald, and, you know, what a great paper, maybe the greatest paper.
The Guardian?
We have, yeah. And he fashioned, you know, leaking himself. They use the paper's credibility, and it all seems to be true. You know, investigative reporting, we're just looking for the truth. The question now is how can we keep it going when all the financing for newspapers, especially and print, is getting smaller and smaller? There is a suggestion by a newspaper, frankly, a small one in Topeka, Kansas, and they're setting up an endowment of well-meaning community organizations and volunteers, almost like crowdsourcing, so they can pay these individuals, and then the newspaper will pick it up and be the voice.
Well, I've heard of ProPublica. Now, what's the organization you're talking about?
Well, this is a newspaper who is doing it. Okay. It's called the Topeka Capital Journal.
Oh.
And I don't know that they have a name yet for the investigation. But God knows, in Kansas, with Governor Sam Brown back, they have a lot to keep going.
Well, so many newspapers have gone to clickbait, and investigative journalism takes time, it takes resources, and it may not be the sort of thing that web viewers might immediately click on.
Yeah. I'll just generally say that, you know, the need for investigative journalism and documentaries is greater now than it ever has been. We do a series called American Greed on CNBC, and it's about greed and how we constantly are being screwed by somebody out there trying to get our money. These are important things. It is all moving toward the iPhone, your computer at home, and, you know, the evening newscasts on network are really obsolete.
It does seem harder and harder for the people on the ground to make a living these days.
It does. And, you know, we have gone from astronomical salaries to much cheaper ones. Local television, it was creeping up, but now they know, hey, there are a lot of people who really want to do this, so we're going to not pay them as much. I think the kids today are better trained, better educated, as, quote, journalists, but they are not allowed. They don't have the platforms that we did. We were swashbuckling, you know. We could go out and, well, the Agent Orange, our documentary, replaced the 10 o'clock news, our big newscast.
Wow.
And 7 minutes was nothing in those days.
Back when there were three channels.
When you could, really have investigative reporting. But if you look and search and are really interested, you can find the source of information on the web, even visuals, you know, on YouTube. Almost anything that happens now has a video to go with it. So I think we're on the verge of wonderful things.
It's still a labor of love for so many people.
And therein lies the definition of a documentarian. You know, they say that they do the same thing that filmmakers do, but without a script. You know, it's usually a married couple, very often. that will devote 6 months to a year gathering, you know, in all seasons, the video, the visuals. At the same time, they're working other jobs to stay alive. And I narrated one just the other day, and they knew there aren't many people who are going to be watching this. But it will be played in every museum and every piece of government, you know, in all the big cities around the Great Lakes. Because why? And it will change laws and have an impact. And that's what you want to have as a documentarian.
The long memory.
The long memory. Why will it? And why do they work so hard? Because of love, of the passion. And thank God there are still people out there like that.
Bill, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for dropping by.
I love it. I love it. I love your studios. I love the show. And it's a pleasure to be here. And love Portland. Hey.
Yeah, have a great time while you're in Portland.
Thank you.
This is SW Concert for KBOO.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. 1,300 registered nurses at the Kaiser Permanente Los Angeles Medical Center began a four-day strike Thursday. From the L.A. picket lines, striking RN Aisha Ely says nurses are frustrated that they aren't getting the staffing and resources they need to provide the best quality patient care.
We are nurses. We are here. We're not trying to jeopardize our patients by being out on strike, but what we are doing is that we're advocating for our patients. We're fighting for our patients so that we're able to give them what they need. So, and the message that I would like to give to Kaiser is just work with us. Give us what we need so that we're able to do our job. We don't want to be out here. We have to take a stand to have our voice heard.
Ely says staffing is short at Kaiser's Los Angeles Medical Center, so short that nurses often can't take work breaks.
Right now, we're severely understaffed. Almost every unit in the hospital does not have enough nurses to properly care for our patients because we're so severely understaffed.
United Way of Illinois says 1 million people have lost human services due to the state budget standoff triggered by Governor Bruce Rauner's anti-union demands. Nearly two-thirds of human service providers have had to cut programs. Half of these agencies say if the budget stalemate continues for 6 more months, they'll have to stop serving clients altogether. AFSCME says Rauner's so-called turnaround agenda attacks public worker collective bargaining rights and the state prevailing wage, while seniors face massive cuts in home health care, and tens of thousands of families have been denied child care assistance. Rauner is demanding that the legislature accept his anti-union agenda before a state budget is completed. Railroad workers want you to know that federal regulations are needed to prevent railroads from running freight trains with just one person. J.P. Wright of Railway Workers United.
I can tell you right now, from my own personal experience, there's no way that you do not want two people on the front of that train. Even if you're just talking about national security, communities that need a first responder in case of an accident, that's what we are as railroaders. We're the ones that's there before anybody.
The Federal Railroad Administration is holding a public hearing July 15th on a regulation dealing with one-person freight trains. Wright says many rail workers welcome automated systems as a safety overlay, but not as an excuse to eliminate two-person freight train crews.
Think about that. You've got something that's potentially 6,000 tons, 8,000 feet long, going 50 to 60 miles an hour down the track. Just that right there, regardless of whether or not it's carrying a hazmat shipment, just the fact that it's that big of a piece of machinery with one person to be responsible for all of that. No, I can't find anybody that would think that was safe.
More information at railwayworkersunited.org.
Workers Independent News is brought to you by the Office and Professional Employees International Union, online at opeiu.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Severe hurricane force weather caused by El Nino has wreaked havoc in China, Southeast Asia, and India. Tornadoes, hailstorms, and pounding rain have killed 78 people. In China's eastern province, Jiangsu, while injuring some 500 others, 200 critically. In central China, flooding killed 22 people and destroyed the homes of 190,000. An estimated 120 people died in lightning storms across India in 2 days. Meanwhile, at least one of two typhoons headed towards Southeast Asia could hit Taiwan or the northern Philippines with super force by the end of this week. One storm's strength has hit Category 4, with winds topping 130 miles per hour, and the other storm strengths approaching that same category. Domestically, storms with winds up to 125 miles per hour are moving across the Midwestern United States, causing multiple tornado touchdowns, six of them in Illinois alone. Though there have been no deaths, property damage is extensive.
Heads of state and high-ranking officials from across Latin America gathered in Havana, Cuba today to witness a historic moment, the signing of a bilateral ceasefire between the government of Colombia and the rebels known as the FARC, or FARC. The ceasefire is being celebrated as an end to the longest-running civil conflict in the Western Hemisphere. Robert Packard, with our friends at Free Speech Radio News, has more.
Raucous applause filled a meeting hall in Havana as lead negotiators from the Colombian government and the FARC guerrilla army signed a bilateral ceasefire agreement. After more than 3.5 years of peace talks, the deal contains multiple points and conditions that, if satisfactorily met, will lay the groundwork to end the country's 51-year-old armed conflict. FARC leader Timoleon Jimenez, known by his nom de guerre Timochenko, told those at the signing ceremony that the deal is not a surrender, but the result of earnest efforts on both sides.
This is not a capitulation of the insurgency, as some stubborn opponents would like to see it, but rather the outcome of a serious dialogue between two forces that confronted each other for more than half a century, each without being able to beat the other. Neither the FARC nor the state are defeated forces. Thus, what has been agreed to cannot be interpreted by anyone as the product of an imposition of one party upon the other. We've been in discussions for a long time, and even arrived at what seemed like dead ends, but we were able to work through them thanks to the fair-minded and effective intervention by mediating countries, Cuba and Norway, and well-timed and wise suggestions of creative spokespersons on both sides or of their astute advisors.
As part of the Cessation of Hostilities Pact, the hemisphere's oldest guerrilla army has agreed to a UN-monitored disarmament timeline, while the government has vowed to create a program to help demobilized FARC members re-enter civilian society. Both sides say there are more details to hammer out before they can draft and sign a final deal to end the conflict, but that they expect to have a working agreement by next month. Hardline groups in Colombia, especially powerful interests that allegedly financed right-wing paramilitaries, have loudly opposed the peace process. Colombians will be able to vote on whether to accept or reject the final peace deal in a nationwide referendum. For FSRN, I'm Robert Packard.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Abby Sloan, S.W. Conzer, and Martin Dodge. The producer is Sound Bowman. Special thanks to the Free Speech Radio News. Our engineer is Matthew Olson. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and K282BH Willamette on 104.3 FM and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Natasha Delapine.
And I'm Sam Bowman. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Positively Revolting, hosts Ani and Lynn speak with poet, author, and reproductive activist Judith Arcana about upcoming street theater with the Birth Control Brigade. Next Wednesday, June 29th, they will remember the arrest of birth control advocate Margaret Sanger in Portland 100 years ago. At 9, on One Land, Many Voices, we'll hear Israeli researcher, scholar, feminist, and social justice activist Dalit Baum speaking on everything you always wanted to know about BDS. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints Investigative News Radio with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, it's Pacific Underground, Asians and Pacific Islanders in Oregon taking the mic into their own hands. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. Not a current member? You can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. That's kboo.fm. Thank you for listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth. Good night, Natasha.
Good night, Sam.
Good night, Matthew.
Good night.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Grassroots activists all throughout the region are working against houselessness, but there is one organization looking at it from a different perspective. It's called Living Stages. Tamara Lynn with Living Stages and Terry Light with Right to Survive spoke with KBOO's Lisa Loving about how Living Stages can impact communities. Find out more about their work at www.livingstages.org.
Living Stages is a theater organization here in Portland, and we use theater as a form of community engagement, empowerment, and collective action.
And you have something happening very soon.
Well, right now we're working on a project, and we're working on a number of projects. We have a partnership with Right to Survive that we can talk about today. It's called Home is Where the Heart Is. We've been creating theater about the experience of being houseless, and then inviting audience members and neighborhood associations to step into the action and try to change the course of the play.
All right. And so I would like to hear a little bit about Right to Dreams piece of this.